He's dead? He was murdered by drug dealers? As I nodded, an old-fashioned bell clanged loudly out in the empty corridor for a moment and stopped. I can't believe it, she said, blinking. He was so smart. It doesn't make any sense. Some of the other students I talked to said he gave them drugs, namely ecstasy. Did he ever give you any drugs, Lisa? I asked. No, she said, not looking at me. The rapid snap of her lighter was loud in the empty room. That's a lie, she said after another second. Yes, he gave me drugs. Ecstasy, ketamine, even crystal meth once. I never even really did drugs before. He was really interested in their effects on me, like obsessive about it. He sometimes even gave me a survey sheet to fill out like it was an experiment. I'd heard the same thing from some of his other students. He must have been using them as guinea pigs for his drug batches, testing their strength so he could price them accordingly. His own students. He easily could have poisoned or killed them. Aruda was a real piece of work, all right. We were sleeping together, Lisa suddenly said as she looked out the window. You probably heard that, I'm sure. I thought I loved him. I guess I did. She snapped the lighter again and again. I'm so stupid, she whispered. Lisa, I said, patting her on the shoulder. Don't blame yourself. This guy was bad news. I'm not here to pry into your personal life, really. I'm just trying to find the guys who killed them. Were you two together a lot? Did he ever take you to his house or maybe to an apartment in Hamilton Heights? No, he would pick me up over on Broadway and we would go to this motel in the Bronx. I'm from a small town in Rhode Island and at first I thought it was kind of gritty and exciting, you know? Like that old police song, Don't Stand So Close to Me. She made a disgusted face. Then he started being a jerk to me after a month or so, but I couldn't stop seeing him. Lisa, did he mention if anyone was after him? Maybe you heard him talk on his phone about someone or something he was worried about? He was always cryptically talking on his phone, Lisa said, shrugging again as she darted a pained look at me. Only in Spanish, though. He could be rude like that, speaking in Spanish in front of me to people like I didn't exist. I was sad when I first heard the news, but I think I'm happy now, Detective. In fact, I'm glad the bastard's dead. Lisa, if this is too much for you to deal with, they probably have counseling services on campus. Maybe you should talk to someone. Maybe, she said with another shrug. I don't have a lot of friends here. New York, I mean. It's so cold at times. I'm thinking about maybe going home at the end of the semester, get my head straight. That might be a good idea, Lisa, I said as another bell sharply rang out in the hall. Here's my card. Don't hesitate to call if I could be of help to you. You've been through a lot. Thanks, Detective. Maybe I will. Chapter 21. After a day spent digging dry holes, I finally lucked out by walking smack dab into the middle of Bennett Pasta Night when I got home. Mary Catherine must have been part Sicilian somewhere way back in her family tree, because the Irish lass made the kind of meatballs and marinara gravy Martin Scorsese's mother would have been proud of. I gleefully pulled up a plate and sat down beside our new house guest, Marvin Peters, who'd come home with Brian. Marvin was a big African-American kid, about 6'4", with double-wide shoulders and a boyish, round, soft face that made him look approachable despite his formidable size. He looked like a friendly bear. He also looked a little shell-shocked as he sat staring at our frenetic dinner table. "Quite a sight, isn't it, Marvin?" said Seamus, who was sitting on the other side of him. "But I'd be doing more shoveling than staring if I were you." "He's right, Marvin," I said. "You'll need to tap into some of your athletic skills at mealtimes around here if you want to feed yourself before it's all gone." "But I can't tell you how much I appreciate you letting me stay with you, sir," Marvin said, staring at me earnestly. "All you guys are such kind people. I don't know how to thank you."
"I do," said Seamus, as he swirled spaghetti on his fork.
A Catholic school win in the All-City Basketball Finals this year should do quite nicely. Also, Manhattan College would be a grand school for you to play for in a few years. A grand school with a fine Catholic tradition right here in the city of your birth. Seamus, would you please stop recruiting Marvin at the dinner table? I said. I can't believe I had to actually say that. What? A priest isn't allowed to support Catholic schools now? Seamus said. We've been locked out of the All-City 3 years in a row, and Manhattan needs to make it back to the dance and quick. Marvin here is fierce powerful, so he is. Just look at him. He's our meal ticket. Seamus, do I actually have to send you to your room? I said as everyone started to giggle. He's a real priest, Marvin. I swear, I know it's difficult to believe. Oh, don't worry about it, Mr. Bennett. He turned towards Seamus. I don't know about Manhattan College, sir. Father, I'll have to look into that. But I'll do my best for you to win this year in the All-City if we get there, I promise.
Don't let Seamus bother you, Marvin. He just likes to tease, said Mary Catherine, not missing a beat with our newest family member.
Marvin smiled his friendly bear smile.
Hallelujah, Seamus said sheepishly.
Chapter 22 Puller ready, President Buckland said as he gently shouldered his Mossberg over an under 12-gauge shotgun.
Ready,
said his son Terence, a safe 20 feet to his rear.
Okay, let's see one, Buckland said.
There was the familiar click and whang of the remote control trap machine, and then two clays were aloft in front of him. The little terracotta frisbees bobbed a little in the cold air as they sailed for the tree line of leafless poplars and maples and white oaks, as if trying to get away. As if. Buckland tracked textbook smooth from the waist, and then, two quick shotgun blasts later, another two clay pigeons were subtracted from the world.
You're on fire, Dad,
Terence said as he gave his father a high five.
It was some pretty sweet shooting, wasn't it, son? Buckland said, glancing over at the First Lady who sat smiling by the fire pit.
One might even say it was done with perfect execution, which only makes sense. My being the head of the executive branch and all, he winked at his son. Terence groaned along with his mother. The three of them were at Camp David, the famous presidential retreat in rural Maryland, standing beside the snow-filled tennis court where they'd set up a trap shooting rig. Some presidents jogged or golfed to blow off steam. Buckland liked to shoot things. The family actually had a regulation skeet course built at their personal vacation place in Pennsylvania.
Trey classy, his wife said, after Buckland picked up the tall boy can of Heineken at his feet and took a pull and burped.
If only the press could see you now. Where's the paparazzi when you need them?
Now, no more stalling, scaredy cat. I do believe it's your turn, Buckland said.
The blast of the First Lady dusting her true clays were still ringing in the air when the black Chevy Suburban pulled up behind their security detail back on the road.
Were you expecting them? She said.
I'm sure it's nothing, honey. I got this, President Buckland said as he started walking over to Secret Service head John Leviton, standing by the SUV's back door.
Don't waste your breath, President Buckland said as he sat in the back seat. You drove all the way up here for nothing.
Mr. President, please be reasonable. We can't go back to New York.
Not now. It's just not safe. We haven't tracked down the shooter, who, by all evidence, is a world-class sniper. These guys are wizards, sir. The amount of exposure they need is almost nothing. You need to back down.
No, it's Russia that has to back down, President Buckland said.
This situation we're facing, John, is bigger than all of us. We have to show unity right now, not fear. Besides, even if it all goes to shit, and it won't, since you guys are the best, there are worse things than me being dead. Far worse. Like Russia taking over Western Europe. I strongly advise you not to go back to New York right now.
I hear what you're saying. I'm listening. I really am, the president said, as he watched his wife kill a couple more clays and share a high five with their son.
But I'm going to New York, the president said as he opened the door.
Chapter 23
The beat-up white work van pulled into the empty parking lot of the Kohl's in the Caesars Bay Shopping Center in the South Brooklyn neighborhood of Bath Beach at 3:47 in the morning. Immediately, it rolled to the lot's waterside guardrail beside the closed shopping center and stopped and stood idling. Beyond the guardrail, far off on the dark gray water, were the yellow running lights of a ship, a large ship that had just sailed in off the New York-New Jersey Bight into Lower Bay. In the van's passenger seat, Matthew LaRue lifted the $3,000 FLIR Scout II thermal camera from his lap and thumbed the zoom. After some more pans and zooms in the black-and-white display of the infrared camera, he finally read MV Vestervig off the ship's starboard side.
"Is it her?"
asked LaRue's wife, Sophie. "It's her," Matthew said. The container ship MV Vestervig flew under the Panamanian flag and was owned by a Japanese shipping concern. It was a hefty Panamax-class vessel that had a capacity of 4,500 containers and was now heading inbound for the Port Newark Elizabeth Marine Terminal, he knew. Having done nothing but go over the job for the last 3 weeks, he knew all about it.
"Isn't it ahead of schedule?"
Matthew checked his Rolex.
"A little," he said. "How long do you figure?"
she asked. LaRue put down the camera and looked out at the tiny lights on the water. He scanned up the bay to the right and bit his lip. Containers average about 25 knots, he knew. Plus, you had to time this right. Couldn't be too early. Not a lot of wiggle room in this one. "Give it 12 minutes on the button," he said.
"From here?"
"From here," he said, putting down the camera and climbing into the back of the van. He just slipped into all the gear and rechecked the kit bag when his wife's iPhone alarm started ding-a-linging.
"Ready?"
she said.
"Hit it."
She zipped the van out of the lot and got them up on the ramp for the Belt Parkway West. LaRue held on to the back of her seat, looking out the windshield as they drove. The dark water on their left, the lights of Staten Island on the other side. There wasn't a car on the road. Another mile up, they took exit 3 on almost two wheels to West 278 and then got in the lane for the lower level of the Verrazano Narrows Bridge. Half a minute later, they were under the upper deck, girders steadily going by on the right beyond the low concrete divider wall. They passed the first of the suspension bridge's 270-story towers, and then Sophie slowed and stopped the van mid-span, and he jumped out with the bag and the ropes. A car went by on his left a minute after Sophie drove off. He didn't even glance at it. In his coveralls and reflective vest and bridge worker's hard hat, he knew he was wallpaper. 20 paces up from where he'd been dropped off, he found the pre-marked girder, set up his 6mm accessory cord anchor around it, and then clicked onto the 200 feet of climbing rope and chucked the rope over the side. Under the sodium light beside the bridge's guardrail, he knelt on the concrete and looped and clipped the rope into his rappelling harness's melon and tightened the lock. Then he climbed out over the rusted guardrail and leaned back out into the wind and space.
Chapter 24. On the outside of the bridge, Matthew descended a few feet out of sight of the roadway and waited, dangling there 20 stories over the dark water. When he tilted his head back, he could see the lights of Manhattan sparkling against the cold night. It arrived less than a minute later. He looked down, and rolling beneath him was the mighty arc of the MV Vestervig's bow, followed by the orderly rows of colored containers stacked up from its hold like hundreds and hundreds of giant Legos. The swoosh of the massive ship pushing through the water drowned out the whistle of rope through the Malon as he lowered himself in a slow, controlled rappel. He stopped himself when he was 10 feet above the top row of containers and stared at the wheelhouse coming at him. The container top sliding by beneath his boots looked like the cars of several slow-moving trains. He lowered himself some more, and when he was 5 feet above the plane of rolling container steel, He let go with his brake hand and landed on his side on one of the container tops with a hollow thud. He lay there for a full minute, listening for some outcry. The ship had a 23-member crew, but only 2 navigation officers and an engineer worked the night shift. But there was nothing, just the wind and the rhythmic slap of the water off the ship's moving hull. Good, he thought, as he took his map out of the bag and clicked on his flashlight. Even with the exact bay, row, and tier on his ship map, it took him 5 minutes to find it, a battered blue Maersk box on the top row. He sniffed through his high-security bolt seal with the cutters he'd brought, creaked open the container's swinging door, and stepped inside and swung it closed behind him. My, 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 he said, as he passed his flashlight over what was inside. It was a car, but not just any car. A sleek, museum-grade 67 Lamborghini Miura, cherry red with a mustard leather interior. It was worth well over $1 million. Stop your drooling and get to work, he mumbled to himself as he opened the supercar's door and pulled the latch for the hood. Under it, instead of the engine, there was a spare tire and the battery. LaRue reached into the bag and brought out the device. It was a sheet of plastic explosive along with a small, radio-controlled detonator and a microphone. After activating its transmitter, he reached in under the hood on the driver's side and sealed the device up against the chassis, just to the right of the left front wheel well. Then he wiped engine grease all over it until it was hidden. After he finished, he tested the device's signal, then closed the hood and the car's door and smiled. Now, unbeknownst to the owner, the occupants in the car could be heard, or better yet, killed at any moment. He checked his watch. Okay, time to go. He came back out of the container and resealed it with an identical high-security bolt seal from his bag. When he climbed back on top of the container's roof, he could see that the ship was already in the tight Kilvan Cole waterway that separated Bayonne, New Jersey, from Staten Island's North Shore. Some industrial tanks went by along the right shore of the shipping channel. Then he passed a smaller container ship, called a feeder, sitting at a dock before he saw the Bayonne Bridge. With only 150 feet of clearance from the bridge to the waterline, the huge MV Vestavig's radio and radar antennas would clear it by only 20 feet. He spotted the rope ladder hanging down off the bridge a minute later, and he walked over the tops of the containers and caught it and quickly scurried up to the bridge deck. He had to wait a few minutes, hanging from the bridge's guardrail, after the ship was gone, before Sophie arrived. How'd it go? She said, after he collapsed in a ball of sweat onto the floor of the van's rear. Swimmingly, darling, just swimmingly. Chapter 25. The next morning at 20 minutes before 9, I was sitting and staring at a Norman Rockwell print. It was one of my favorites, the one of the big state trooper seated beside the cute little runaway kid at the diner. I loved all the incredible colors and details, the deep blue of the trooper's uniform, the focal point red of the bandana tied to a stick under the kid's shiny chrome diner stool. I thought it was a heck of a painting, but then again, I suppose you could accuse me of being a little biased in the cops and kids department. The prints hung on the office wall of Chief of Detectives Fabretti, who had texted me for a meeting on my way into One Police Plaza. Beside the print on a whiteboard were crime scene photos. One was of the MetLife building's roof, another of the assassin's blind that we'd found under its rim. Beneath them was a shot of the huge Barrett 50 caliber sniper rifle we'd been unable to trace or find even one print on. I hoped the chief wasn't looking for an update on things, because there was none. It was pretty frustrating. We were no closer to finding the president's shooter than on day one. Yeah, okay, I know, I'll call you back, Fabretti said into his cell as he came in and loudly dumped the bunch of binders he was carrying onto the smooth glass top of his desk.
"The frickin' president is making another visit to the UN. Can you believe this?"
he said as he dropped himself into his tufted leather office chair.
"That was Paul Ehrenwein. He just got off the phone with the Secret Service. Does Buckland have a death wish? I mean, some in the press like to say he's like the new JFK. You think he wants to end up like him?"
"When is he coming back?" I said.
2 weeks. They said he has a big meeting with ambassadors from a bunch of the former Eastern Bloc countries and some NATO ones. They said he's trying to put the full court press on Russia. Really up the pressure."
"Well, he's upping the pressure, all right," I said, shaking my head.
"You said it," Fabretti said. "My blood pressure alone. Just having to work with those Secret Service prima donnas again, after all they did to try and throw us under the bus, is an outrage."
"I'm with you there," I said. "Anything else, Chief?"
"Well, now that you ask,"
said Fabretti, as he took a sheet of paper out of one of his binders. Chapter 26. In the last daylight of my long day, I stepped out of my unmarked into the parking lot of a big, ugly, yellow concrete building in Brooklyn. It was the last most southern building in the South Brooklyn Marine Terminal, a massive industrial wilderness of rusting chain link and corrugated sheet metal just south of the Gowanus Canal. Icy wind off the bay roared in my stinging ears as I crossed the parking lot. I looked up at the looming silhouettes of a couple of massive dock cranes at the adjacent facility, where imported cars were processed and put onto freight trains. "This must be the old Brooklyn," I thought, turning up the collar of my coat. There wasn't a hipster in sight. The inside of the building was even more depressing than the outside, if that was possible. It was a meat distribution center, basically, a giant refrigerator stacked with row after endless row of cardboard cases of frozen meat. Beyond a smudged window by the front door, workers in hooded winter coats piloted forklifts and pallet lifts between the rows, like lost souls doing penance in a frozen hell. I found Pavel Levkov upstairs in a cozy, warm glass office, overlooking the interior tundra of the warehouse. He was a medium-sized, bald man in his 50s, with gray eyes and a weightlifter's build. He didn't offer me a seat. I'd actually been looking for him all day. He was a hard man to find. He had a list of cash businesses as long as my arm. A bunch of gas stations in Newark, a slummy motel in Coney Island, a garbage-hauling outfit out in Staten Island. Though Levkov didn't have a record, he was linked to the Russian mob in New York. He was also linked to the informant who'd told the FBI about the MetLife shooter. Apparently, the FBI's informant had split town yesterday out of the blue, but not before telling his wife that if something happened to him, we should talk to Pavel Levkov. So here I was.
"NYPD, what the fuck is this about?"
Levkov said after I showed him my shield.
"How do you do, Mr. Levkov?
My name's Detective Bennett, and I'd like to ask you a few questions. Actually, just one. Who put the hit out on the president? Was it you?" The Russian immediately started laughing. I'd really hit his funny bone. He crossed his arms as he creaked his bulk back in his old wooden office chair, giggling.
"Yeah, it was me. You found me out, Detective. Welcome to Dr. Evil's lair,"
Levkov said with a theatrical wave of his meaty hand. He sat forward then, leaning on his desk with his elbows.
"I'm just a businessman, Detective. Look at this place. Do I look like I'm getting rich to you? Look at my car in the lot, some piece of shit Jeep Cherokee with a bad transmission. How many times do I have to tell you people I pay my taxes and pursue the American dream? That's it."
"We have reason to believe that's not just it. Maybe you didn't set it up, but I know you know something. I need the shooter. He killed a cop. We're not going to stop looking for him. You choose to stand between us and him, you're going to find your little grimy empire coming down around your ears. You need to give me something. If not the shooter,
than a name that gets me off your ass and on theirs. Think hard. I'm actually trying to help you.
You're crazy, Detective. I voted for Buckland. I don't know who put my name in this, but you need to arrest them because they're pulling your chain.
Okay, Levkov. Let's do it the stupid way.
Get up and put your hands behind your back.
What? Why?
I took out the subpoena that I had been handed by Chief Fabretti for the over $3,000 in unpaid parking tickets the Russian had racked up. Well, Pavel, sometimes the American dream includes paying your parking tickets.
Chapter 27. So how do you like the madhouse so far? Brian Bennett said, as he huffed and puffed next to Marvin Peters. They were jogging in Riverside Park after school.
You don't have to answer that. It's only for a few weeks, right?
Madhouse, Marvin said as they ran. You don't know how lucky you are, man. Your dad and Father Seamus and Miss Mary Catherine and all your brothers and sisters, not to mention this neighborhood. Heck, you live in the good life, believe me.
Yeah? Tell me that again after one of the peewees gets into your stuff, or the first time you slip on a Barbie roller skate in the middle of the night.
Marvin just smiled. They were coming out of the icy trail by the Riverside Drive sidewalk at 86th when Marvin spotted him. Hardly believing his eyes, Marvin slowed to a stop. It really was him. Big Flicka himself, just standing there by his big double-parked silver Mercedes, smiling.
Hey, what gives, Marv? Getting soft on me?
Said Brian. Marvin didn't answer. All he could do was stare out at the street beyond the snow-filled park, at the big, lanky 50-year-old black man in the black $1,000 Canada Goose down jacket. As Flicka gave him a wave, Marvin remembered a snatch from some old stupid 80s song, Get Out of My Dreams, Get Into My Car. Only here in real life, it was like Flicka had just come out of Marvin's nightmare, and Marvin only wanted him to go back.
Marvin, Marvin, you were a friend of mine.
Flicka sang soulfully. He had a nice voice. Ghetto legend had it that he actually did some backup on a couple of tracks in the 90s before he got caught for a body.
Marvin, it is you, isn't it?
Flicka said.
I thought it was, and I was right. Look at you, son. It's been too long.
How had the bastard found him here in Manhattan? Marvin thought. He must have spotted him at school and followed him here.
Come here, boy,
Flicka said, tilting his head to one side playfully.
What, you're not even going to say hi?
Marvin didn't want to go, but he did as he was told, because Flicka was effing crazy. Full bore, hockey mask, chainsaw, crazy.
You didn't know what Flicka would do until he was doing it. Tell your white boy to keep going his merry old way or I'll clip you right here, said Flicka, still smiling like he was posing for a selfie. I'll do you just like I did your cousin, and the white boy too. You know I will.
Hey, Brian, you keep on going, Marvin said.
I'll catch up with you later.
Maybe we should just head home, Marvin,
Brian said.
I won't be long, Marvin said.
Okay, Brian said. You're sure?
Marvin nodded.
Yeah, keep going, white boy,
his cousin's killer said as he opened the passenger door of the Merc.
You don't want any peace of this punk ass's sorry problems. Not any peace at all.
Chapter 28. Saturday morning, Matthew went into the famous Strand bookstore on Broadway, down from Union Square Park, while Sophie got her hair done nearby. He was deep in the stacks, flipping through a coffee table book about depictions of pain in Renaissance art, when a big guy in a hooded wool toggle coat and Clark Kent glasses jostled him in the narrow aisle.
You and your girly art books, Mark Everard said under his tobacco breath.
Yeah, well, Matthew said, cocking an eyebrow at Everard's Brooks Brothers fall weekend ensemble. At least I don't dress like one.
You're losing it. A corn-fed Indiana boy like you letting me sneak up on you like this?
Everard whispered as he elbowed him.
You have a minute?
Matthew closed the book on the photograph of Laocoon that he'd been studying. You have a car? He said.
Yeah, but let's take a walk instead, Everard said, gesturing beyond the precarious sea of stacked books toward the door.
They didn't talk as they went north up Broadway, or even when Everard led him across Union into an old pub a block past the park.
Ah, if these tin ceilings could talk, Everard said when he arrived back at the darkened rear booth with their whiskies. Does anything on earth beat one of these when New York was Irish joints?
They were the only ones there so early besides the bartender. Matthew nodded.
What's up? He said.
Good job on the uptown shuffle, Matty, not to mention your antics under the bridge, Everard said as he gently clinked Matthew's glass.
He said you'd come through, and as ever, you're a man who does what he says.
Yep.
That it?
Of course not, Everard said, slipping him a thick envelope under the sticky table. It was the same kind of paper as the one for Rafael Arruda. Thick stationery, scratchy. You could feel the threads in it. Matthew tried to hide his shock and numbness as he tucked it inside his jacket. He had thought they were done. He'd thought wrong.
So he's here? Matthew said.
Everard took off his glasses and rubbed out his dark doll's eyes and then put the glasses back on.
He's here, he said. The last of the Mohicans, Matthew mumbled.
The last? Everard said as he turned a thick glass tumbler in his big hand.
And most dangerous.
Matthew's eyes went wide as he figured it out.
Wait, the president thing?
He gasped. With the MetLife and the chopper and the cop?
Yep, said Everard, nodding. He might have had him, too. Rumor is in the blind there was a big old Barrett zeroed in. Who knows what would have happened if that cop hadn't gotten lucky?
Matthew did the quick calculations in his head. Lex to First Avenue, little over a mile.
Just might have had him at that, Matthew said with a whistle.
How did he get in, though? I thought he was in Dubai. Everard shrugged his grizzly bear shoulders and his prissy coat. Though he looked like an academic, the Chicago native had played defensive tackle at the University of Michigan before he tore his ACL.
Who knows? Mexico? That barn door is wide, Everard said. It ain't like before. Everything's screwed up now, Matty. Truly, madly, and deeply. Why do you think I'm sitting here with you?
And he's still here?
Far as we can tell. But check the paperwork. You have to talk to a guy first. But you know this bastard. He's just like you, Matty. He likes to finish a job. You sure you're down for this? Should Sophie be sitting here with us?
No, we got this, Matthew said, patting the envelope.
Believe me, this one we've been waiting for.
Not just you, Everard said into his Jamesons.
Then we're done. Matthew said as if he were talking to himself. One last one, and it's all over.
To the ending, said Everard, staring into Matthew's two blue sniper's eyes as he raised his glass.
Of a nightmare, Matthew agreed, as he clinked and tilted and drank.
Chapter 29. The assassin's wife made a right off Pell onto Doyer Street in Lower Manhattan's Chinatown and stopped and checked the address on her phone again. Tucking her phone away into her large knapsack, she looked up into the fearsome face of a paper dragon draped in the tourist shop window in front of her.
Oh, aren't you cute, she said,
walking past it alongside the graffiti-covered steel shutters beneath the dirty store awnings. Around the bend of Doyer's, across the street from the Chinatown post office, she opened the door of a small, ugly green brick building and promptly scrub-picked the cheap lock on its inside door. Quickly and quietly, she went up the small building's four narrow, sour flights and then opened the door to the roof. Directly outside the doorway was a black wooden water tower, and she quietly walked to it, ducked beneath its metal base, and knelt and unzipped her bag. The rifle she removed from it was a suppressed short-barreled Macmillan CS-5 loaded with specially made 200-grain subsonic 308 caliber ammo. She flicked out its collapsible tripod and stock and laid it on the gritty tar paper and put her eye to the scope. Down below her was the crazy four-way intersection of Chinatown, where Bowery met Doyers and Catherine in Division Streets. She glanced up Division Street and rolled her neck and got comfortable. Then she dialed her phone.
"In position," she said.
Chapter 30.
"Okay, love, look lively,"
her husband said from the van parked two blocks east over on East Broadway. Hanging up, he glanced at himself in the mirror attached to the rear van wall. He was dressed once again like a cop now, an NYPD beat cop, with the iconic yellow and light blue patches on the shoulders of his midnight blue jacket and a metal badge on his peaked hat. Knowing there would be witnesses and maybe even phone video of what was about to go down, he had a fake mustache now and was wearing brown tinted eyeglasses. But the key to his disguise was hiding his race, courtesy of his wife's expert makeover, which gave his skin a warm brown Hispanic tone.
"Okay, you got this, you got this, you got this," he said, pumping himself up as he stared in the mirror.
Then he rolled open the door and jumped out onto the street. He threw out a hand to stop traffic as he hurriedly crossed East Broadway, and then crossed the sidewalk in two steps and pulled the handle of the Bijou liquor shop door. The old guy behind the counter reading a Chinese language paper gave him a look of sheer bewilderment as he drew his Glock. Without a word, the assassin rushed toward the back and kicked open a cheap wooden door at the right-hand rear of the crowded store.
"NYPD! Nobody move! This is a raid!" he yelled as he rushed in behind the Glock.
40 or 50 Asians, looking as shocked as the counterman, stared at him through thick smoke. They were sitting in groups of four at small, green felt card tables covered in purple-backed tiles. It was a mahjong parlor, a 24/7 illegal gambling house, one of the biggest in New York City. He scanned faces, looking for the one he had already memorized, his target, Richard Yu. He spotted him a second later at one of the farthest tables, a young guy with a New York Knicks varsity jacket and a mop top of spiky hair, like a crazy anime character come to life. He seemed younger than in the picture Pavel Levkov had given him. What this girlish Asian kid had done to have a $200,000 contract on him was difficult to comprehend. But, as was true for most old soldiers, his was not to wonder why.
"You, Spike, stay right there! Hands! I want to see your hands!"
Yu peered back at him through his blade-sharp hair, then suddenly jumped up and hit a door to his right, fleeing into the back alley. The assassin hit the edge of a table, sending Chinese character tiles flying as he ran across the parlor and threw the door after him. Surprisingly, Yu was already hopping the alley fence to the parking lot when he came outside.
"Good," the assassin thought as he followed at a jog. "Run along now."
The parking lot on the other side of the fence had only one way out, he knew, right into the middle of Division Street.
"Coming to you,"
he called into his phone to his wife. He heard the low report of the suppressed rifle off to the left just as he was coming out of the parking lot. He looked ahead to his right down Division and saw Yu running flat out in the street beside the parked cars and traffic. He was cradling his left shoulder with his right hand as he ran. He was dripping blood. Some was splattered on the pale sleeve of his jacket. She'd nicked him. There was another shot, and a hole appeared in the side of the dirty, graffiti-covered box truck Yu was passing. The round had landed right beside the Asian version of Usain Bolt's spiky head.
"Damn it! He's out of sight and range," she said into the phone. "It's okay. Get out now. I got this,"
he said, seeing the drips and lines of blood splatter on the asphalt as he picked up the pace. Chapter 31. The assassin reached the end of the block just in time to see you dart under the shadowed base of the Manhattan Bridge. When he arrived at the other side, he saw you make a right onto Pike, and when he reached Pike, he saw you make a left onto Henry.
"Damn, this little kid is fast," he thought as he ran down Pike Street. "I'll give him that."
Two surprising things happened almost at once as the assassin turned at a run around the corner of Henry Street. The first was a funeral procession coming out of a church right there, off the corner beside him. A crowd of mourners dressed in black stood on the corner, respectfully waiting as pallbearers brought a coffin down the steps. The second and far more interesting thing was that Richard Yu was standing past them at the end of the short block by the subway entrance to the F train, pointing a gun at him. He dove in front of the hearse as the gun went off. Several mourners in the crowd screamed as one of the elderly pallbearers fell and the coffin clattered down the steps. He poked his head around the hearse just as Yu fled down into the subway.
"Hey, what you got? What you got?"
yelled a jacked cop who appeared suddenly from the park across from the church.
An armed robbery, in pursuit of an Asian male," the assassin said as he took off. "Just went into the subway. Didn't hear nothing on the radio. You call it in?"
the young, eager cop said as he ran beside him, matching him step for step.
"Not yet. Just happened. Can you?"
the assassin said as he took the subway stairs down two by two, trying to distance himself from the real cop.
"Damn it,"
he thought as he arrived at the bottom of the rancid steps and saw that there was a train in the station. He heard the doors bing-bong as he reached the turnstile and hopped it, and dove into the car at the last second through the closing doors.
"Yo, dude, help!"
said the cop, who was now wedged in the doors of the train car. The assassin looked at him. Then he lifted his foot and booted him square in the center of his muscular chest, knocking him sprawling onto the filthy East Broadway station platform. The doors rattled closed, and the train pulled out. He ran to his left down the train through the cars, following the screams. He ducked. There were more shots and the sound of breaking glass as he pulled open the door to the last car. He couldn't believe it. The window in the door at the end of the train was missing. The punk Asian kid had actually broken it somehow and escaped. Or maybe not, he thought as he ran the length of the car. He arrived at the door and saw Yu rapidly disappearing in the distance in the glow of a tunnel bulb, his anime hair casting spiky shadows on the wall. The assassin calmed himself. He cleared his mind and body with a breath and put the sights of the Glock 23 on the orange Knicks basketball in the back of the kid's jacket and unloaded. He watched as Yu took two more steps and fell face first between the tracks. The assassin smiled as the train reached the next station and the doors opened.
"Nice chase, Richard. You were just outclassed, son. Professionals never quit," he thought as he hurried for the exit.
Chapter 32. Paul Ernenwine was standing beside Chief Abretti when I opened the door of the cramped observation closet on the third floor of One Police Plaza.
"Hey, Paul, what's up?"
I said, with mock cheeriness, as I shook the middle-aged red-headed Fed's hand, as if I didn't know. It was too bright and too warm in the tiny space. The overhead fluorescent buzzed like a trapped, angry insect. You could smell and almost taste the frustration in the close air.
"This nut won't crack, huh?"
Ernenwine said, cocking his chin at Pavel Levkov on the other side of the one-way mirror. I looked over at him glumly. The muscular Russian was whistling as he drummed his fingers on the table he was sitting at. He had looked like that ever since I dragged him in, like a hapless, lackadaisical guy with nothing to do, patiently waiting for a bus. "That's an affirmative," I said, as I tried to roll the tension out of my neck. "I tried three times, but our Russian friend here is about as communicative and cooperative as a cinder block. Any word on your informant that he scared away?"
"None," said Paul. "We're up on his wife's phone, but so far, Jack.
What's crazy is we have a crack Russian mob squad, and this Pavel here isn't on any of our lists. He doesn't go to any of the clubs out in Brighton Beach. We even checked his bona fides with our counter-intel people on Ruski spies, but he came back clean.
Exactly, said Fabretti. Besides the parking tickets, he's never so much as gotten pulled over for speeding.
I mean, he looks mean enough, said Paul, but he's not even remotely on our radar. I can't for the life of me think why our informant is so scared of him. A guy like this, who seems so deeply connected, pops out of the blue, makes me want to consider retirement, purchase some land in northern Wyoming, maybe.
I checked my watch. Whatever it is, we can't hold him forever. What do you want to do?
Paul yawned elaborately. Then he passed a hand through his thinning orange hair.
Let him walk, Paul said finally, taking out his phone. I have a team of my guys waiting downstairs to cover him. Let's put a little slack in this dog's leash. Who knows? Maybe he'll lead us to where he buried the bone.
Chapter 33. After his release, Pavel went straight to the Bronx to the most secure of his several residences.
Eat it, you stupid cops, he mumbled as he hit a remote on the sun visor of his Jeep. He looked in the rearview mirror as the electronic security gate closed behind him, sealing off the driveway of his property on East 233rd Street. He had noticed at once the three-car surveillance detail when he came out of the Brooklyn impound yard. They wanted to watch him? They could do it from far away, from the street. Maybe later, after dinner and a couple of drinks, he'd go to his window and give them something to look at, namely, a good long glimpse at the glowing white cheeks of his ass. He came up the winding driveway toward the rambling old three-story Tudor house. Its six-acre wooded lot was completely sealed in by old rusting chain link. He had bought the place in 2001 to build a housing development, but he never seemed to get around to it. He got out into the circular drive.
"What the hell are you doing, eh? Sleeping on the job?" he said, as he knelt and kissed his two Dobermans, Sasha and Natalia.
He kept them within a tight perimeter around the house with an electronic dog fence that he called his moat. The dogs whined at him hungrily now.
"Okay, fine ladies, I'm a sucker for such pretty girls."
He took the creaky front stairs two by two and opened the big oak door into the dark and drafty front hall. The house had great bones, as they say. Like so many of the house's fine appointments, the elaborate mahogany staircase had been shipped over from a French chateau when it was built, but the house needed a couple $1 million of work. Originally, at the turn of the century, it had been the compound of a paranoid, apocalyptic religious group, and though he kept it to himself in the house at night, Pavel sometimes heard some wild, unexplainable shit. Footsteps, doors slamming. A few times, what sounded like screaming. If he didn't sleep with his girls, a deadbolt lock on his door, and a fully loaded Armsell Striker Street Sweeper semi-automatic shotgun on his bedside table, he might have actually been scared.
"Hey, ghost, I'm back. Miss me?" he said to the shadows as he headed to the butler's pantry to get the girls their dinner.
He was coming back into the kitchen when his knee exploded. He didn't feel it at first. It happened so fast. He was just walking toward the drawer to get the can opener, and then he was collapsed on the yellow pine floor with a bloody, ragged hole in the knee of his slacks. "Pavel, hello down there," said a voice. Starting to hyperventilate at the growing pain, Pavel looked up at a distinctly unghostly-looking blue-eyed man who stepped out of the shadows with a smoking, suppressed H&K Mark 23 in his right hand. "You don't know me, Pavel, but my name is Matthew," he said. The sniper smiled as he squatted, getting down on his level.
"And I have a couple of questions for you today."
Chapter 34.
"And the plot thickens," said Paul Ernenwine,
as we stood by the nurse's desk at the second floor ICU unit of Montefiore Hospital in the Norwood section of the Bronx. Pavel had been admitted at a little after 2 in the morning. A cab had come to his place, and the surveil team had followed it and Pavel to the emergency room. He had some broken ribs and electrical burns on certain sensitive parts of him, and someone had put a .45 clean through his right kneecap. Apparently, he'd been worked over by someone who knew what they were doing. Who that someone was, we didn't know, but we were very interested in finding out. We're obviously getting some promising results in the Pavel seems to be a player hypothesis, I said. Who do you think tuned him up? All three of the Pep boys by the looks of him, said Paul, pointing at the console screen, which showed a bruised Pavel covered in cords, sleeping. The Russians, the Kremlin, I said. You'd think, right? Said Paul, but why leave him alive? What does the house look like? I said. Clean. Too clean. He's got dogs. Plus, there's no sign of entry. Someone picked the locks, it seems. There was water all over the kitchen floor. Either Pavel decided to do some bobbing for apples after he kneecapped himself, or he was waterboarded. You think it was the president's shooter? Pavel was a middleman, and something got screwed up and the shooter needed to find out some information the hard way? That's a good theory, Paul said. We should use it. You want me to go say hi? I said. Can't, said Paul. He's got some internal bleeding. Doctor said we need to wait until the morning. Maybe this works to our advantage, I said. If he spilled the borscht about something during his little inquisition, he might be in big trouble, right? We could offer him some sanctuary. Paul Ernenwine looked at the screen. Good night, Pavel. Sleep well. We'll more than likely flip you in the morning, he said. Chapter 35. At 11:15 that evening, Sophie, wearing a large camping backpack, walked east down East 20th Street, past the Gramercy Park neighborhood's charming Italianate and Greek Revival townhouses. She sighed as she passed the awning of the famous Players Club, which had been founded by Edwin Booth, the brother of John Wilkes. Astors had lived in the famous neighborhood. Steinbeck, Thomas Edison, even Julia Roberts. Though she lived in Soho, she sometimes fantasized about moving onto the famously attractive historic block with its exclusive, mysterious private park. Too bad she wasn't here to house hunt. Her pick was already out as she got to the Irving Place entrance to the park. A moment later, its famous cast iron gate briefly shrieked, and she was in. She walked alongside snow-covered benches and hedges to the statue of Edwin Booth in the 2-acre park center. Walking past it, she panned her eyes left and right along the small park straight and winding paths. But it was too cold and too late for anyone else to be there. Good. She cast a quick glance at the Gramercy Park Hotel straight in front of her. Then she walked back to the statue and casually dropped the massive backpack she was carrying at its feet. She quickly zipped open the bag, making sure the flap was pulled all the way back. She scanned it. Everything looked good. Wired tight. A moment later, sans backpack, she exited through the Irving Place gate and continued east down 20th, picking up her pace. It's in place, are you? She said into her Bluetooth. Chapter 36. Just a sec, said Matthew up in the windy darkness above her, looking down at the park and the city lights. The building he was on top of was a block behind her, on 19th, just in off Park Avenue South. It was a 12-story pre-war office building, uninhabited, with a sidewalk shed and black mesh wrapped around its edifice due to a major rehab. His setup was pretty sweet. There was a brick structure atop the roof that housed the elevator equipment, and he was on top of that, belly down on the tar paper behind a tent made up of several sheets of the black construction cladding. The rifle he lay beside was one of his favorites, a precision XM24 SWS with a long suppressor and 5 300 caliber Winchester mags in its detachable box magazine. Up on its bipod, it was pointed across the park on his target at the Gramercy Park Hotel, Suite 809, to be exact. It had taken Matthew a long, busy, and messy 2 hours to persuade Pavel to tell him where he could locate the man he was looking for. No one knew the assassin's real name, not even Pavel. The assassin was a hard old bastard who'd been around forever and whom they called the Brit. A true mercenary, he worked for the highest bidder. And tonight, his long career was going to come to its inevitable end, Matthew thought, leaning into his rifle's fixed cheekpiece. Matthew blinked as he looked through the S&B nightscope. It was already dialed in on 809's floor-to-ceiling window, in off the corner of 21st and Lex. Beyond the curtain of the big window, the end of a low, dark leather couch and the edge of a huge, modern splatter painting on the wall were visible. It was a joke of a shot, really. A little over 200 yards on a slight left-to-right, four-story downward angle. He could have almost hit it with a pistol at that range, but it was windy. A steady 10-mile-an-hour wind was blowing out of the northwest. He needed the pop of the XM24 to compensate. The setup was straightforward. Get him to come to the window with the distraction, then blow out the first visible vital part of him with a 300 caliber Winchester supersonic boat tail. Matthew wasn't the biggest fan of distractions. They worked far less often than people thought, and were just as likely to make your quarry alert as to trick them. But then again, everybody let their guard down sometimes. "Okay, talk to me. On your call," said Sophie in his ear. Matthew took some breaths, then closed his eyes.